Hi, I'm Jason Wacob, founder and co-CEO of MindBodyGreen, and your host for the MindBodyGreen podcast, where I'll be bringing you deep and insightful dialogues with some of the greatest minds in wellness. If you like what you hear, please consider giving us a 5-star review and comment. And don't forget to visit us at MindBodyGreen.com for your daily dose of wellness, and make sure to check out all of our great offerings, including our online classes and trainings. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Jason Wacob, founder and co-CEO of MindBodyGreen, and your host for the MindBodyGreen podcast, where I'll be bringing you deep and insightful dialogues with some of the greatest minds in wellness. If you like what you hear, please consider giving us a 5-star review and comment. And don't forget to visit us at MindBodyGreen.com for your daily dose of wellness, and make sure to check out all of our great offerings, including our online classes and trainings. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Michael Chernow is a celebrity chef, restaurateur, entrepreneur, and wellness fanatic. He got his start in the restaurant industry at age 13, and after struggling with addiction in his 20s, got himself sober and began his wellness journey. Since then, he's opened New York City restaurant favorites The Meatball Shop and Seymour's, which is one of my personal favorites as it focuses on sustainable seafood, something which we're going to talk about today. Not to mention his other venture, Well Well, a line of functional beverages, which we all love here at MindBodyGreen. Mike's a passionate, can-do type of guy who's run marathons and even ventured into bodybuilding. You'll leave today's podcast nothing short of inspired. It's an honor to have him here on the show today. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. One of our favorite local chefs, restaurateurs, entrepreneurs. Great to have you in the house here in Dumbo.
I'm super pumped to be here.
So let's rewind. Let's go back to your evolution and started a while ago and kind of decided to, as I read somewhere, you stopped drinking and started running. So so what happened there?
Well, you know, I think if I close my eyes and I think about just life in general, right? It's a story. And my life has been a crazy story so far. You know, I grew up in New York City, in Manhattan, and I went to public school, and I was exposed to an enormous amount of the good and the bad from an early age. But for whatever reason, from as early as I can remember, I've always thought entrepreneurially, like always. I've always wanted to figure out a way to be creative and capitalize in somehow, some way, shape, or form. So, you know, I started dog walking when I was 10. I had a full-fledged dog walking business until my parents put a kibosh on it because it was getting out of control. I was walking like 30 dogs in my neighborhood. And then I got a job in a restaurant when I had just turned 13 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. Before I worked in the restaurant, I was delivering videos. Because that's when, you know, videos were still a thing.
VHS,
in 1993, and I was delivering videos for Couch Potato Video. A buddy of mine who was a year older than me was answering the phones at a restaurant for the delivery department, and he said, "Hey, man, you're delivering videos. You can deliver food too if you want." And they were two blocks away from each other, so I ended up doing it, and I got a job there at that restaurant. Ironically, a vegan restaurant.
Which restaurant?
The Candle Cafe.
It's still around.
Still around.
Yeah.
Still around. And so I did that. And I mean, I hate to sound cliche, but, you know, when I walked into the restaurant, I felt like I had arrived. I really did. I had always been passionate about communication because communication is a huge part of my life just in general. People are what drive me. Making people happy are what drives me. And so that sort of fueled this fire for my career, but also fueled this fire for drinking.
Sure.
and becoming comfortable, because I loved being in the mix so much, and I was always the youngest one, and so alcohol really became a part of my life early on, and then very quickly soon after, alcohol, drugs. I worked in the restaurants. My parents really didn't have much control over me. My household was a bit rough, and so I just sort of escaped into restaurants and alcohol and partying at a young age. And I moved out of my parents' place when I was 15, and I was just a wild man on the streets of New York, and I stayed working in restaurants, and I worked my way up, and you know, I was a delivery boy and a dishwasher and a back waiter and a busser and a bar back and then a bartender, and then ultimately, you know, I'd become somewhat of a downtown kid in the restaurant industry. I always maintained a job in a restaurant or a nightclub. And then when I was 20 years old, I landed a job that I had for 8 years at a restaurant in the East Village, with 1 year hiatus when I tried to live in Los Angeles and hated it. Nothing against LA. I love going there, but it's just tough for a New York City kid to move out there. But anyway, so I got a job in this restaurant, and it was really great restaurant, hot spot. I mean, packed every night. I was sort of like the man behind the bar. And my drinking career really took off there because I didn't have, you know, it was part of the culture there.
What was the place?
Called Frank Restaurant.
Sure.
It's one of the best.
Still around,
it's
too.
Still around. It's one of my favorite places on the planet. I grew up in that place. If it wasn't for the owner of that restaurant, I would not be sober today.
From like 2nd Avenue.
Second Avenue, between 5th and 6th.
I think I had like my 25th birthday there.
Probably.
Yeah.
A lot
you
of people
may have
did.
Served me.
I probably did. Chances are I lived in that place.
You may have served me way too much there.
But anyway, so I parted my brains out. Really, you know, I was a fun guy to be around, but it was a dark place for me to be. And finally, my boss took me aside after sleeping through work one day and said, "Mikey, I love you like a son, but I can't watch you do this to yourself. Like, I'm just not going to watch it. You know, you're fired. I'm not going to let you do this." And it was, you know, I think for him, because he knew how much I meant to the restaurant, because people really like were there, you know, people came to see me on a regular basis. I just have this way with people. And so he made a sacrifice by firing me. My job meant everything to me. It was like, really, I loved my job there. And he said, "Look, man, I don't want to fire you. But I'm not going to watch you do this, and I'm not your father. But if you commit to getting sober, I'll let you have your job back. And here are the sort of stipulations. You have to show up to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. You're not bartending for the next 30 days. Just show up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you got to clean with the porters. And you got to call me at 8 a.m. the minute you get in. And if it's a minute late, you're fired. And if you drink, you're fired. And if I find out you're drinking, you're fired." And so I took him seriously. And I got into the program. And I haven't had a drink since. And I was 23. And thank God for that man. He saved my life. And
how old are you now?
I'm 38.
So 15 years. That's serious.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Thanks. Big deal.
Yeah, and a couple of guys, you know, who I knew from before I got sober, sort of knew that I was a project, or could be a project, and they took me to a Muay Thai gym, and these guys were sober. They took me to a Muay Thai gym, and they threw me in the ring, and they said, "Take out your energy here, and then once you're done taking out your energy here, put on a pair of running sneakers and go for a run." And I'd been an athlete as a kid, but it was just a whole new world for me, and I locked in. I just locked in. It became my life, fitness and wellness. And so they taught me how to eat. They taught me how to train. And I was between working at Frank and at the Muay Thai gym. I was at the gym for 4 hours a day, just like locked into training and discipline. And that's where I learned everything about my structure and foundation today, through Muay Thai martial arts.
Wow.
And yeah, it just changed my life. And running has become and was at that time a real opportunity for me to get outside of myself and also inside of myself. And you know, I would run super long distances and think about things I can do and things that I haven't done yet. And yeah, you know, it gave me a platform to breathe again. I was really underwater there for a while.
So how do you feel at that moment when you were confronted? And it's on the way here. I was actually reading a tweet. I can't remember who tweeted it, but it was something along the lines of, when you confront someone about having a drinking problem, 70% of those people will try to convince you they don't, and 30% of those people will try to convince you they don't, like having a, which is a real, like, how did you, seems like right away it just clicked.
And yeah, I mean, I knew for a long time, you know, I'd been, you know, I didn't like gradually get worse and worse. I like from like the age of 14 years old, I was just in it.
Full speed ahead.
Yeah. And I'd been introduced to outpatient rehab, and you know, I'd gone to a couple of AA meetings in my early teens or my mid teens. So I knew that there was a real problem. I just wasn't willing to, or wasn't ready to address it. And the hard part about alcoholics and alcoholism is there's zero you can do for anybody. You can be the kindest. You can welcome people into your home. You can pamper them. You can feed them the best food on the planet. You can, you know, tell them you're going to work out with them and give them, you know, the sort of world is in the palm of their hands once they stop drinking. At the end of the day, unless that individual is ready, willing, and able to stop, it's useless. And so, you know, I spent years not ready, even though people would tap me on the shoulder and be like, hey, dude. When Frank addressed me, I, for whatever reason, was sick and tired of it. And I knew that I had a lot more to offer, and I needed somebody like Frank, a guy that I really looked up to, who had what I wanted, to just tell me that, you know, it's time, man. You got to freaking get it together.
Well, the restaurant industry, although I think it's changing from what I hear, by nature, is just brutal. It's a lifestyle. It's exciting. You're in the restaurant. There's energy. People are happy to be there. And then after, you go out, and then you go to other restaurants. And I've been with chefs when they go out to eat, and it's like they get thrown every dish and the drinks, and it's hard to say no because it's you don't want to be disrespectful. And I see how you get caught up in it.
Yeah, it's an indulgent industry. Yeah. That's what it is. You know, it's an indulgent industry, and it's changing now, I think, in many ways. But you know, the magic happens after hours. The magic happens when the sun goes down. You know, and so as a bartender, server, restaurateur, chef, you don't feel the success until 8 o'clock at night. You know,
right.
Like that's when it starts. And so unlike most jobs, you know, if you're doing really well, the sun is up, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And like it's daytime and you're that's when you feel the success. In a restaurant industry, when you feel the success, most of the time, it's like 8:39, the restaurant's packed, everybody around you is indulging in food and alcoholic beverages, and people are getting dressed up and trying to look good.
Yeah.
And sexy. And so like that's the environment that you're in, you know, that's when the real magic happens at night. And so, yeah, I think that is the culture of the nightlife. And so it's definitely, for the people that work within it, it is really difficult to separate the sort of the technical part of the industry, which means the people that are working in it, from the consumers.
Sure.
Because it begins to just all mesh together.
Yeah, there is a great, when I bartended in college, there was a line from the guy who owned the bar owner was like, I'll have a drink with you at the bar around the corner, but not in my place, because then it's very hard if you own the bar or the restaurant and you start drinking there, work like it's dangerous.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who are successful in industry draw a line.
Well, at any of the restaurants that I've opened, and now there's been
a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I've opened 15 restaurants in my career. You know, number one priority and goal to drill in from the very, very beginning is that there's just absolutely no substance consumption whatsoever, period, done. It's the one thing outside of blatantly stealing that people will get terminated on the spot for. It's the one thing. I'm happy to pick the ball up after you've dropped it three times, four times, help you out, train, cultivate, mold, help you see your potential. But if there's alcohol or drug use or you steal, it's over.
Well, I think it's becoming, you know, guys like you, our friend Seamus Mullen, I was talking to Tom Colicchio about this, you know, Sean Brock, like a lot of guys who are pretty well known who were saying like, hey, lifestyle needs to change and this is what works for us and here's how we're thriving. And that's a big deal. I feel like the culture is shifting in your industry.
100%.
you know, mental health, we all know, like, you know, Anthony Bourdain, like, it takes a toll. It's serious.
Well, it's also an industry where you get to experience the either gratitude and or it's sort of like when a chef makes a dish and sends it out to a guest, and there's an open kitchen and that person can follow that dish right to that person, watch them for 2 minutes and see if what they've produced has been a success or a failure immediate. It just happens that fast. And so the pressure is just on constantly, specifically now, you know,
people are reviewing you while you're eating. It's like, I was talking to Amanda a long time ago with Amanda Freitag about this and John DeLucci. And they were like, it used to be you'd wait for the New York Times, the paper to drop. Now the paper is dropping every second by someone
every time a dish comes out of the kitchen, every single time something walks out of the kitchen, you have to believe that somebody's going to take a picture of it, post it, and write something.
Yeah.
And you just hope it's positive because you never know who's sitting at the table. And so, yeah, the pressure is tough and, you know, and the hours are tough. The hours are tough. Just because the restaurant's open from 5 to 11 doesn't mean that there's not, you know, 15,
you don't show up there at 5.
Right. You know, there's a lot of work that goes into it. You know, I ate dinner last night at Crown Shy. A buddy of mine who just opened up this beautiful restaurant, and it was just like, you know, he's been talking to me about it for, you know, a year and a half, and it's come to fruition, and it's incredible. And to see how happy he is, his name is James Kent. We actually went to high school together. Oh. He was at EMP for many years, and then he went over to Nomad, and he was the executive chef at Nomad, and then he left Daniel and Will and finally taking his own.
Where is it? I'll check it out.
It's on Pine Street. It's down in the financial district.
Got it.
And it's just, it was a magnificent meal, you know, and it's just like, I can just see, because the room was packed and it was buzzing, and I could feel the energy coming out of the kitchen was just like, we did it, you know, and it's just, there's no better feeling than that, honestly. You know, people, like, there's like this, you know, the rich guys and the rich gals are always like, oh, I'm going to open up a restaurant, you know, just for the fun of it. It's so hard.
Oh, yeah.
It's so hard. But when it works, it's just like, you know, it's incredible.
And so going back to, you know, you start running, you start taking wellness seriously. So you're running, you're doing martial arts. And, you know, recently you were on Instagram, you know, I was saying, like, I don't know if you were half serious, half joking. You're like, I'm going to be a bodybuilder now. Looking at the photo of you on Instagram, I'm like, I think he is a bodybuilder. Like, you're in the best shape of your life. And so talk about that evolution and, like, your routine. So, like, your guy is busy. You got multiple restaurants all over the place. You got two young kids, yet you're super serious about wellness. And you got another business too. Well, what's we're talking about? You got a lot going on. So what do you do? Like, what do you eat? Your workout routine? How do you make it all work? Because a lot of people will say, well, I'm like, I don't have time. But somehow you make it all work.
Well, you know, I think I spent years trying to figure out the balance. You know, I opened up my first business when I was 28. So, those first couple years there, I lived and still live in Williamsburg. And my first restaurant was in the Lower East Side. So for the first 2 years, I didn't get a chance to really go to the gym because I lived in the restaurant. And so I would wake up early in the morning. I'd put all my work clothes in a backpack tight to my back, and I'd run to work every morning. And then when I'd get to work, and, you know, it's so funny that, like, I have staff members that are still working at the meatball shop that remember this, I would do over 1,000 push-ups a day in the bathroom, just because fitness is a huge part of my life. So I guess I should start by saying fitness and wellness are a massive part of my life. My priority in life is my family, 100%. Right, that's my number one priority. I read something somewhere recently that said, like, priorities should not be plural. it is a priority, right? My priority is my family. So that's just, let's just take them out of the equation, because Everything is for them, wholeheartedly. I try to stay fit and healthy and well so that I could play sports with my kids forever. You know, like, I don't want to be like the, you know, the guy that's like, oh, I want to play, you know, throw a football with my kid at 13. Like, I want to be able to run marathons with my sons at when they're 40 and I'm, you know, 80. Like, that's the way I see it. So I'm fitness, you know, plays into my family, and business obviously plays into my family. So ultimately, priority family. Then there's like other pillars in my life that I don't sacrifice. So there's business, there's fitness, and then there's, I guess, like alone time for me, which I don't really get as much of. I haven't figured out that balance yet. But things get busy and crazy. I wake up at 4:30 in the morning to get to the gym. It's necessary for me. Like, I don't, you know, when people are like, I don't have time, that's BS as far as I'm concerned, right? Like, you can make time if it means enough to you. And fitness and wellness means enough to me that I will schedule it into my day like a meeting every day. I don't miss it because I know that for me, what fitness is a win. Every time I do it, it's just a win. And we all like to win. And so if I can't win at everything that I'm doing, because that's unrealistic, I know that if I get to the gym and get a good training session in, I've won. And that if that's my only win for the day, that's my only win for the day, and I'm happy. And so I do it. And, you know, people will call me crazy, and maybe I am, but I need to do it. And I do it, like, intensely because it means so much to me. I feel better. I feel better. And we have to do things today, specifically with all the technology and the hyper-communication and accessibility. Just, we have to do things today, as far as I'm concerned, that are physically rewarding. Mm-hmm. Because the stresses of life today really bog us down mentally. And so if you do something that's physically rewarding, it ultimately affects your mental state. It just does. And so physical fitness and taking action that way is absolutely necessary for me. And so what do? I challenge myself. So I've always got a new challenge. You know, I run the New York City Marathon last year. A friend of mine said, hey, what's your next challenge? I said, you know, I'm not sure yet. I know I'm running the marathon next year and I'm going to try to do a faster time. But she said, you know, you should try bodybuilding. And I was like, bodybuilding? She was like, yeah, you should try it. She's a bodybuilder. And so the next day I just looked into it and I found a coach and just went for it. And I trained really hard for it. I trained, I signed up immediately for a competition because I work really well, specifically in fitness, but also in business. I don't set goals for my family because I don't want to have that pressure in the family arena. But for business and fitness, I set goals always. And I signed up for a competition that just passed last Saturday in Los Angeles. And I took it very seriously, like as if I was a pro bodybuilder. Like that was the way I approached it. And I did good. I came in the top 10.
That's awesome. Well. Congratulations.
Thanks. But I believe that, you know, I think with wellness in regards to nutrition, what you put into your body, and fitness or movement, what you do with your body, for me, I tend to have a better outcome in my journey if I have a goal set. If I'm just like aimlessly sort of eating or training, it's not as meaningful to me. So I like to set a goal, have some sort of a finish line, and then I just jump right into the next.
So now that you're in the professional arena, so you work out every day, non-negotiable in the morning. I get why people work out in the morning. You don't miss it. There's no excuse. There's no meeting that happens at 6 a.m. Mm.
So, well, yeah. I don't always work out in the morning. I sometimes, you know, I'll work out, you know, if I have the opportunity, I'll work out in the afternoon. But if I don't have the opportunity, and if I know that, like, I got a business to open, which has been a part of my life, I'm not going to subject my business partners with my personal need to train. So I will wake up at 4:30 in the morning and get out of the house by 5 and train from 5 to 7, home for breakfast with my kids and take my kids to school.
But you never miss?
Never miss.
Every day?
Every day, six days.
What's the minimum? I'm curious, what's the minimum time in the gym and maximum? I know it's probably evolved.
You know, it all depends on the goal that I've got set for myself. But ultimately, I'm probably on average in the gym an hour and a half. You know, for this bodybuilding competition, it was definitely longer than that. So I was lifting weights for 2 hours, and then I'd always have a 30-minute cardio thing at the end.
So how do you eat now? I'm curious, as someone who's technically a professional bodybuilder.
Well, you know, I'm not pro. I didn't get my pro card, but
I have a feeling you'll get it if you want it.
I think I could probably get it next year if I wanted it. Yeah. Now at least I know what my competition is. So I've never counted macros before this bodybuilding competition. Mm-hmm. So this bodybuilding competition introduced me to macro counting, which is both incredibly informative and also extremely dangerous for me, because now I know the implications of nutrition in a much more finite, detailed way. So I'm trying to back off of the macro stuff, like, but it's so ingrained in me. My wife is like, are you really going to weigh your food still? Now that you're not doing this anymore, do you have to weigh out your food? But, you know, I also enjoy structure. So I'm not going to necessarily weigh out my food, but I've got a good eye for portions now.
I'm sure you do.
So I'm just, you know, doing it without having to put the burden on my wife about weighing out everything. Because literally for 5 months, I weighed out every single gram of food I put into my body.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, maybe before then, how did you eat? Because you're still in pretty darn good shape pre-bodybuilding. So let's go to, how did you eat pre-bodybuilding generally, like what your food philosophy is?
Yeah, so I have an 80-20 philosophy where Monday through Friday, I eat clean. And that means predominantly lots of greens, lots of veg, and protein, sort of, you know, fish and chicken. And then light carbohydrates, not a lot of carbohydrates. You know, I tend to use the sort of, I'm not like a huge fan of gluten. So I'll eat quinoa and brown rice and sweet potatoes for my sort of carbohydrate intake. I'm definitely 60% veg, 30% protein, 10% carbohydrate.
What about fat? What are your favorite healthy fats?
I love avocado. So yeah. Avocado is a huge part of my diet. It's just, I could eat avocados all day long. And for the year, for about a year leading up to my bodybuilding competition, I was intermittent fasting. And so I wasn't eating until around 12 or 1. And then—
How many hours in between was that for you, in between meals?
16-hour
fast. So you did the 16-hour?
Yeah, 16-hour fast. And then I would eat for about 8 hours.
Still do that or no more?
My competition was up on Saturday. I'm letting myself sort of like ease back into whatever the next thing is going to be. I think the philosophy of intermittent fasting is great. I enjoy the sort of clarity from intermittent fasting. And I also enjoy like sort of having those healthy fats in my body, more so that like using that as energy as opposed to just carbohydrates. I feel like carbohydrates are fast energy. So if I'm going to go train, that's when I'll have carbohydrates, like, you know, an hour before lifting or training and within an hour after. Otherwise, I feel like carbohydrates kind of drag me down. I have nothing against them, but it's just
my, nothing against them.
Yeah, but, you know, I feel like it. There's carbohydrates in everything, right? So like not everything, some proteins don't have carbohydrates, but ultimately a lot of vegetables carry carbohydrates, and I enjoy carbohydrates from vegetables as opposed to like sort of more complex carbs. But I use food functionally a lot today. Like that's how I think about food. So obviously flavor and texture is very important to me. I'm a trained chef. I enjoy that. So that's 80% of my diet. And then 20% of my diet, which is Saturday and Sunday pretty much, I'm upstate with my family and I love to barbecue and eat, you know, steak and make burgers. And, you know, I believe that we need that balance. I think that it's not only healthy for our mental state to be able to enjoy food like that, but it's also great for the people that are around us. You know,
sure. Like
my wife gets real happy when I sink my teeth into a fat burger.
What's your, what is your favorite vegetable?
Favorite vegetable is probably broccoli.
It's a good one.
I love broccoli. I just love broccoli.
And you mentioned seafood, and something you're passionate about is sustainable seafood and something that's incorporated into Seymour's, which our office loves here in Dumbo and I love too. And just talk about why sustainability in seafood is something that's so important to you and so important to all of us.
Well, as I said, I grew up here in New York City. And from about 9 years old to about 13, I played on a sports team. And every Sunday, our sports team would pack into a bus early in the morning, and we would drive out to Captree or Freeport, Long Island, and we'd go fishing on the party boats. And my dad loved fishing. For whatever reason, fishing has just been a big part of my pastime life. I enjoy fishing. I really just enjoy.
Remember, Colleen and I saw you on New Year's Eve. We were eating at Seymour's a couple years ago, and you were going to like upstate New York to go fishing. You were leaving at like 3 a.m. or something in like the freezing cold.
Yeah.
To go, like, I was like, wow, you're serious.
Yeah, that was serious. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I it's just it's something that I truly love. And when I knew it was my time to take a step back from the meatball shop, you know, the vision and the dream was already there in my head to open up a seafood concept. And so the more I dug into seafood, the more I was almost discouraged to not open up a seafood restaurant based on the status of the ocean right now. You know, I just started lifting up rocks and finding out all sorts of stuff that I wasn't excited about. Like, if we keep eating seafood the way we're eating seafood by 2048, there's not going to be any left. And that, like, for me, like, scared the pants off of me. I can't imagine not being able to eat from the ocean. Like, that's, it's like the main source of protein for me. It means so much to me.
It's less than 30 years.
I know.
Like, that's our lifetime.
Yeah. And so that's a National Geographic quote. I can't, I don't know the sort of validity behind it.
Sure, but it's directionally accurate.
Yeah. You know, when I read that, it was just like, I couldn't believe it. And so I said, you know, let me start looking into some of the species of fish that I grew up catching, because you never see them on menus ever. And I said, these fish can't be depleted. When was the last time I saw bluefish on a menu? Or when was the last time I saw porgy on a menu? Or skate or monkfish? I mean, you see monkfish here and there, flounder, black bass. Like, these fish that I grew up catching, you just simply don't see on menus on a regular basis. You do see a ton of tuna, an enormous amount of salmon, shrimp, scallops, halibut. So I started looking into the species of fish that swim local to New York, the fish that I grew up catching, and sure enough, they were incredibly abundant and totally sustainable. And I said, that's it. That's what I got to do. I've got to take a risk, and I've got to put a highlight on the fish that swim local to New York that are totally sustainable, that are incredibly abundant, and introduce the common sense eating to the New York City market. Because, you know, why do I have to fly fish from 5,000 miles away when there's a plethora of fish right here, 100 miles away, 75 miles away? I don't even need a plane. I can drive there and pick up the fish for the restaurant. Like, who would have thought? So, you know, that was the idea behind Seymour's. I wanted to do what I did for meatballs, for fish, open up a really fun, accessible concept that put a highlight on sustainability, because I believe if you're not thinking sustainably today for everything, just because there's so much in the air and there's so much in the ground that we have no control over and is absolutely 100, and I'm not like a, you know, conspiracy theorist, but it you just look at the numbers.
Sure.
You know, like, it's real. Like, there is things that are happening to people at large today that were not happening to people back in the day. And it has all to do with non-sustainable act.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, if the more sustainably we can live, the better off we'll be. And so that's what Seymour's is. Seymour's is trying to disrupt the tuna, salmon, halibut, you know, shrimp epidemic we have. And there's six of them now around New York City, and we'll probably take it out of market next year. And we've done really well. And people, no one bats an eye. You know, no one bats an eye. We have opened the doors to aquaculture for the first time starting January 1st. So we are using green-rated farm-raised salmon just because the guests, we needed to do it. And you know, I was really hesitant to open the doors to aquaculture only because I think there's a lot of controversy around
it. Yeah.
And but at the end of the day, if you are claiming to be sustainable, you have to look at it and be open-minded. And so that's what we are. We did a lot of research. We spent over a year in R&D trying to find the right products.
Some people just say wild or bust.
Yeah. So we've done it, and we love the product, and our guests are really happy that we've done it, and people really appreciate that we're listening to them. And so along with, you know, today on the menu, you know, between there's bluefish, king mackerel, and you can have a piece of salmon too.
I love it. So what other sustainability is clearly on your mind, and I think on the minds of a lot of other chefs and restaurateurs out there? It's hard to ignore it. What other trends are you seeing in the industry right now that, you know, where do you think things are going?
You know, technology offers an opportunity for people to be more efficient and also lazy. And so more and more people are not eating out. More and more people are ordering in. And that's just a fact. And what we have seen for sure is that for the first time in history, probably, you know, people are lining up by the thousands for a tossed salad, right? That's never happened before. I mean, there's been tossed salad restaurants and tossed salad bars for decades, but rarely have you ever seen a line down the block. Like the hottest spot in every city is the salad spot.
Yeah, Sweetgreen.
Yeah, Sweetgreen proved out something that no one ever thought would happen, and it's marvelous, right? It's like it's wonderful to be able to say, "Holy smokes, people are opting for a tossed salad over a fried chicken." And there's nothing wrong with fried chicken, but you know,
not every day,
yeah. Right? And so, I believe that healthy food fast is what's happening right now. I mean, I don't believe it. I know it. People want healthy food fast for lunch specifically. And it's really great to see. I think the hard part of it is, you know, when you open up so many restaurants, you lose a little bit of the culture that you've launched with. It's just impossible to sustain it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that more and more people are going to probably look to open up sort of cloud kitchens, and there'll be a lot more sort of these ghost restaurants opening up where people are just ordering food from the iCloud, from the internet. And
oh, interesting.
Yeah, and just banking that it's being cooked the right way and served the right way. But, you know, New York City and other markets are very, very expensive, and it's almost impossible to like make real money in New York right now.
There's that great Danny Meyer line, every great restaurant starts with a great lease, especially in New York.
Well, the other thing that Danny Meyer says, which is so brilliant, and he's an icon of mine, and I love that guy, you know, but he says the restaurant industry really doesn't make a whole lot of sense because you're opening up a manufacturing plant on Main and Main. Like, who does that? Right? Like, you know, what other industry is there? Are they opening up? Are they looking for their production facility
right
on the best piece of real estate money could buy? Right. So, you know, that's why the restaurant industry is so tough. Because, man, you know, it's just, I mean, in the places where you have the opportunity to really make money, like New York, where the volumes of people are so strong in comparison to the rest of the world. You know, and landlords, you know, they don't care if you go out of business.
There's another bank that'll take your space.
That's it.
So you mentioned culture, and something I'd be remiss not to mention, which I think is super cool, is you actually like have fitness classes at Seymour's.
Mm-hmm.
Like, talk about that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, so culture, I've kind of coined myself a culture cowboy. Like, I'm not a great P&L guy. I'm not a great operations logistics guy, but I'm certainly a culture guy. And that's what I bring to the table at the businesses that I've launched. And so at Seymour's, I wanted to do something a little different. When I launched it, I wanted to sort of put a kibosh to the stereotype that the restaurant industry is all sex, drugs, rock and roll, and smoking cigarettes. And when we launched Seymour's for the orientation, I brought in yoga teachers, mindfulness coaches. We did a 2-day, 10-hour self-development, hardcore, intense session with a really good friend of mine who was at Lululemon for a while. I wanted to do something that offered value in a different way than, you know, like the staff that I hired for the restaurant was blown away. And by the way, because we did that orientation and we do have Fit Squad, so it's called Fit Squad. Basically, you know, it used to be a lot more often. Now that there's so many restaurants, it's a lot more challenging to do it. But once a quarter, for the most part, we take the whole crew to a fitness studio, or we take one of the restaurants, clear out the restaurant, bring a fitness trainer into the restaurant, and they work out with the team. Or I'll lead a run or a boot camp, or you know, but it's always either in the restaurant or at a studio, and whoever wants to come out of the whole entire 350 Seymour's employees can join in.
I love it.
But I will say that because of that initial orientation and because of the intimacy of that orientation and the way we got to know each other and the vulnerability that everybody was willing to participate in, then 90% of the staff is original.
Wow. That's huge in your industry. It doesn't happen.
Yeah. So, I believe that culture is king. And so I'm launching a new venture that's, I haven't really discussed with anybody, but I'm launching.
Breaking news. I love it.
but this new venture is going to be, I will have a really strong growth trajectory for the food business. It's a fast casual in the health and wellness space, but my goal is not to open up 100 restaurants. My goal is to open up one really incredible, awesome, culture-oriented, community-focused restaurant that stays that way. And our growth trajectory will be in underground kitchens that will service through delivery. So a meal plan. Pretty much.
Wow.
And it's got a really cool focus, the business. I can't divulge that info, but I'm doing it with a really great friend. You mentioned him earlier. He's my partner on the project, Seamus Mullen.
Oh, I love it.
And we're gonna do something really special.
So New York based?
New York based. Yeah, we're really, really pumped up about it. And I think I'm going to be able to apply what I've learned from Meatball Shop and Seymour's. You know, I think I'm the culture at the company. I bring the culture. I create the culture. I start the culture. What I do is I develop a brand. I build a team around it. I corral everybody and get everybody fired up to launch a business. And then we launch. And then I take the business from 1 to 3 to 5 units. And that's where my skill set sort of becomes less relevant because it becomes an operational project at that point.
So do you have a date or a name yet?
I don't have a date. I have a name.
What's the name? Can you share?
It's called Creatures of Habit.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
How about a ballpark date?
I think probably late fall.
Okay. That's safe. It's a good time to open a restaurant in New York.
Yeah, late fall. Maybe.
Call it November.
That might be a
good... for my birthday. My birthday present. I'm early November.
Yeah, it's called Creatures of Habit and spelled with a K. And it's going to be fantastic. Yeah,
I love it. So you got your hands full, and the other venture I have to mention because it's a favorite of Colleen and I is Well. And as I mentioned, Colleen's pregnant and like can't get enough of your dark cacao protein.
Congrats.
Yeah, thank you. We're super excited. But like, talk about that and what you're doing there as well.
So Well, I launched in 2016 with 3 other guys. And Sagan Schultz is the CEO and sort of brainchild behind the whole entire brand and concept. He's an amazing guy. And he showed up to Seymour's with a canteen of deliciousness. He was making it at home. It was a mix of watermelon juice, tart cherry juice, and lemon juice. And that was it, 3 ingredients. And he's a MD, MBA, really smart guy. And he was sick and tired of going to, a supplement store for his BCAAs and not knowing really what was in it and powder into water, just like wanted to do something on the more holistic natural route. And so he did all the research and found that L-citrulline is very, very important when it comes to muscle recovery, and watermelon carries the highest property of L-citrulline out of any natural product. And tart cherry's got incredible anti-inflammatory properties. And we really use lemon juice to sort of balance the flavor with acidity. And so between those two ingredients, tart cherry and watermelon juice, we really thought that we can make an impact on muscle recovery in a much more natural, holistic way. And so I tasted it. I was like, holy smokes, that's delicious. And I put it on my partner Larry Prager's desk, who's like the supermarket king. He owns Dr. Prager's Sensible Foods. And so I said, Larry, man, you got to try this. Really smart guy. Brought it to Seymour's. I fell in love with it. I want to serve it at the restaurant. But I think that we should look a little deeper into it and try to get into a bottle. And so Larry did it, loved it. And then, like, you know, that was it. Larry, Sagan, myself, and Colin, we partnered up and we put some money into it. And we created Well, which was one SKU for about 2 years. When we realized that one SKU wasn't going to cut the cheese, we started working on a real SKU set. And we wanted to expand the offering. And we put six more SKUs out there that we just launched in really, in March, we launched six new SKUs. And so we have two hydrates, two proteins, Recover, which is the original SKU. It's a watermelon tart cherry. And then we have a really awesome Wake SKU, which is sort of like a morning kick in the butt SKU, which is fun. It's got some caffeine in it. And then we also have a Dream SKU, which is helps you sleep really well at night, ashwagandha and stuff like that.
Yeah, they're good. Smart. Good, smart, functional beverage. I was Colin and I were impressed with the... Let's call it the rebrand, or the update. The updated SKUs are
thanks.
Good.
I mean, we wanted to have something for everyone, we also wanted to be we wanted to create a line of functional beverages that actually function.
Yeah, they're good.
So, like, every ingredient that's in there is functional and is actually clinically studied to impact you in whatever way that function is supposed to impact you.
Yeah, you weren't messing around. You got L-theanine in there. I was like, oh, they did their homework. This is good. Yeah. This is good. I'm curious, when you're not bodybuilding, what supplements do you take?
Like, Athletic Greens is my jam. I'm like a huge Athletic Greens, you know, guy. I take Athletic Greens every morning. I take omega-3s three times a day. I take a multi. And I do sneak in pre-workout because I enjoy pre-workout. So I take pre-workout. I do a protein shake every now and again, but I typically get my protein from real food.
Right.
But in terms of supplementation, yeah, you know, I do D3.
Sure.
I keep it pretty clean, you know, in terms of, like, I don't really – this is the first time I've ever explored, like, real bodybuilding supplements.
Different world.
Different world, different man. World. I mean, and it's so intense. It's so intense. Like, once I got to this competition, the amount of supplementation that people use, and this was a natural bodybuilding competition. There were no steroids allowed.
Keep it that way.
Yeah. But, you know, regardless, you know, like, the amount of supplements that these guys and gals take are just incredible.
It's like a third job for you.
Well, there's just, like, you know, like, I saw people walking around with just, like, gallon bags filled with pills, you know. Whoa. And it's just, you know, when you're trying to push your body to, you know, see it's like 2% body fat, which is ultimately where I got down to, you know, it's crazy.
That is crazy. Yeah. So I always close with the last two questions. So, What keeps you up at night, and what has you excited every morning? And then, if you could go back in time and give yourself advice, what advice would that be? So we'll start with up at night, excited in the morning.
I guess I'll use an example from two nights ago. I woke up at 3:30 in the morning, and fear set in pretty quickly. And I guess the idea that I'm an entrepreneur and I take big risks and they can come to a screeching halt at any time. And I have a family to take care of. And so I don't have like a stable, steady income. You know, I mean, I do, but I don't, right? Because sure. I'm the boss. So I'm the leader of the team. So, you know, if anybody's going to take a pay cut, it's going to be me. And I've experienced that. So like, that's the scary part of my life, is that like, I am a risk taker, in a real way and somewhat fearless. I mean, I'm a fearless risk taker. So I walk into things not thinking about failure ever. I'm like an optimistic, just totally optimistic individual. And I think you have to be as an entrepreneur. But, you know, sometimes when you wake up early in the morning and you're alone, and or, you know, you feel like you're alone
with your thoughts in the middle of the night. Yeah. I've been there.
Yeah. So like, you know the deal. It's like, there's no like, no one's cutting my check, you know? And so I guess that's kind of what keeps me up at night sometimes. But for the most part, I'm pretty optimistic, and I feel like no matter what I put my mind to, I can achieve. So, and that's not in a cocky, pompous, sort of like overconfident way. That's just in a, hey, I'm a super optimistic guy. I have a very positive outlook on life. And I know for certain, based on my history, that if there's something that I want, I go get it, period. And so that's the way I sort of approach life. And then what keeps me up in the morning?
Gets you excited in the morning.
Gets me excited in the morning. Well, I love my wife and my kids, so they get me excited every day. But outside of them, I think creativity. I love to create. I just love to create and make people happy. And so those are the two things that really drive me, the ability to create and communicate and make people happy. And so every day I make sure that there's some sort of creative action I'm taking towards a project, towards a goal, towards something. I really look forward to that. I love just like coming up with something new and building. And so that's yeah, creating and making people happy.
I love it. And then if you could go back in time and give yourself advice, you know, maybe it's that moment when Frank confronted you all those years ago. If you could give yourself advice back then, what would it be?
It's a good question. You know, I believe, and I say this for business, but it applies to everything. But the quote that I've come up with for it is, the business of business is relationships. The foundation of relationships is trust. And I think I spent a lot of my youth not trusting, and a lot of my early adulthood not trusting, because I thought that I needed to, like, I was the only one that can do it. If I wanted to succeed, it would have to be me. No one else could do it. No one else can help. And so what I would say, the piece of advice that I would give myself or anybody that's sort of young and listening or going through it, ask for as much fucking help as possible. Sorry.
No, it's all good.
Yeah, ask for as much help as possible. Ask for help in every opportunity you can. Always ask for help. Just ask for help, because having smart people around you is absolutely necessary. Having people that are better than you around you is absolutely necessary. You're actually not smart if you don't have smarter, better people around you. And so I've learned to ask for as much help as possible. And I wish I asked for more help back then, because help is key to success.
I love that. JC, the founder of Movember, the great men's health organization, was on this podcast a year or so ago, and his advice was, if you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room. It's a great quote. I love it. Michael, thanks so much.
So happy you brought me in.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening.